Okay, thanks, David. My name is Justin Schoaf. I'm from Southern Illinois University. And when David first invited me here to talk about weather generators, I asked him sort of what he would like me to talk about. And his suggestion was that I give sort of an overview of some of the methods with a focus on the strengths and weaknesses of the different methods available for generating weather data. And I should tell you, my background is really in climatology. So I hope to meet his suggestion by talking about some of these strengths and weaknesses, but also through discussion maybe to learn something from the people here about what it is about synthetic weather data that's really useful for particular applications that you're involved in. I think weather generators are a good fit for a symposium on time series because stochastic weather generators, or commonly just weather generators, are really just statistical models that are used to generate synthetic time series of weather data. Most applications of weather generators have really been in three areas. The first is in agricultural modeling. And in these cases, you often have insufficient observed data. You have no observed data. And in that case, you can actually interpolate weather generator parameters to generate synthetic weather data for sites where no observed data exists. And lastly, sensitivity studies. So a lot of the weather generator work that I did as a postdoc at Florida State several years ago. And in the southeast, there's a very strong ENSO signal. So one of the things that you can do is parameterize a weather generator separately for different ENSO phases and then run that data through a crop simulation model to see what the sensitivity of yield is to ENSO. The second area of application for weather generators is in the area of hydrologic modeling. So for example, you could couple the output from a weather generator with a hydrologic model like SWOT to understand response to precipitation events, for example. And lastly, the area where most of my work has been is really in climate variability and climate change. And these are areas in which we often need data at a daily time step for impacts assessment. But models don't really, coupled climate models, don't reliably provide data at the daily time step. So there's a real need to be able to produce time series that are consistent with the climate change scenario, and weather generators represent a nice way of doing that. There really are two ways you can do this. The first is what's usually referred to as a delta change scenario. This is where you basically say something like, well, suppose that wintertime temperatures increase by 2 degrees Celsius and summertime temperatures increase by 1 degree Celsius. What's the impact of that? Well, you can use a weather generator to actually generate a time series that accounts for that change in the mean. You could also account for the change in other parameters if you chose to do so. The other thing that you can do is change parameters based on the available output from a coupled model. So change the parameters in a way that's consistent with the model output and then generate a time series that can be used in a climate model. This slide shows some of the available weather generators. And this is not an exhaustive list. This is just a list that I sort of came up with. And the reason I wanted to show this is because if you're a practitioner that's interested in using a weather generator and you look at the literature, this is what you find. And for someone who's not into time series analysis, someone who doesn't really understand how weather generators work, this is likely to be pretty confusing. And so I think this is a real reason to be thinking a little bit more about the fine details from different weather generators. The majority of weather generators have been variations on the work of Richardson and Wright, 1984. And this model is usually referred to as WGEN. WGEN produces daily time series of precipitation occurrence, precipitation intensity, daily maximum and minimum temperatures, and daily total solar radiation. And in some applications, WGEN has actually been expanded to include things like vapor pressure deficit, wind, and so forth. And most of that's really in an effort to get at potential evapotranspiration. Precipitation occurrence usually is the basis of weather generators. And the reason for that is that there's usually some dependence of other variables on precipitation occurrence. That's actually not exactly true. The dependence is usually really on things like cloud cover. So for example, on a day that has a high cloud cover, Tmax is likely to be lower. Because of this dependence, precipitation occurrence is usually generated first. The most common approach for generating precipitation occurrence is the Markov chain model. Most of you are probably familiar with Markov chains, but there really are two characteristics, the state and the order. The state is the number of values the variable can take, so that's usually just two. That is, it's either wet or it's dry, although some applications have used additional classes. So for example, dry, light rain, heavy rain, with some previously determined threshold. The second characteristic is the order. This is a sense of the memory of the Markov chain, the number of previous values used to determine the state-to-state transition probabilities. And the most widely used is the two-state first-order Markov chain model. That model has a parameter set that looks like this. So for example, P00 here is the probability that day T is dry if day T minus 1 is dry. P01 is the probability that day T is wet if day T minus 1 is dry, and so forth. And if you're clever, you probably noticed already that P00 and P01 have to sum up to 1. And similarly with the other two transition probabilities. So that means that the first order Markov chain model is really defined by just two transition probabilities, P01 and P11. And the maximum likelihood estimates for those parameters can be very easily determined just by looking at the observed data. So if you want to simulate precipitation occurrence for, say, day T, then just generate a uniform random number on the interval 0 to 1. Compare that random number to the appropriate transition probability, depending on the previous day's occurrence. And if the random number is less than that transition probability, then day T is wet. Otherwise, day T is dry. In most applications, these transition probabilities are defined on a monthly basis because they're not consistent throughout the year. They do change. This is an example from a station in the southeast U.S. I believe it's in Mississippi. And you can see the monthly values for the transition probability P01 showing quite a bit of variability over the calendar months. Now, what's also often done is we fit, in this case, a cubic spline, but often the first few harmonics are used to get a sense of what the variability looks like as a smooth function. There is a little bit of danger in doing that, especially if you're doing it for the non-temperature or non-precipitation variables. In one application to the southeast U.S., and if anybody hears from the southeast U.S., you'll know what I'm talking about. In some places, like in Florida, the daily minimum temperature is 70 degrees Fahrenheit every day from June till September. And so if you start fitting harmonics, what you actually do is overestimate the temperatures in the middle of the summer where the observations are relatively flat. One of the really common criticisms of this model for precipitation occurrence is that the spell lengths, that is the wet spells and the dry spells, are too short, and especially the dry spells. And because of that, a number of alternatives have been suggested. So for example, you could use higher order Markov chains where the number of parameters increases 2 to the k for a kth order chain. So if you're interested in parsimony, you have to be pretty careful about how you expand the order of the Markov chain. The other question, of course, is how does a practitioner choose the right order? And those of you that have backgrounds in statistics would probably say, well, you use something like the AIC or the BIC, where you look at how well the model performs, but you penalize it a little bit for the number of parameters, that sort of thing. Well, we published a paper a couple years ago in the Journal of Applied Meteorology that looked at the model chosen by the BIC for Markov chain. What we found is that model does not always adequately reproduce the wet spells and the dry spells. So if you're interested in wet spells and dry spells, use that as your metric for evaluating a Markov chain, not the AIC or the BIC. The other thing is that you could use hybrid order approaches. So for example, people have used a first order model for the wet spells, but a higher order model for the dry spells. And probably the most common alternative is what's called the spell length approach, so also known as an alternating renewal process. So you generate a wet spell. When it's over, you generate a dry spell. When it's over, you generate another wet spell. And you have some a priori specified distributions for the lengths of those wet and dry spells. Once a precipitation occurrence model is chosen, of course, we also have to have a model for generating the wet day intensity. The three most commonly used models are the exponential, the gamma, and the mixed exponential. And this is a graphic from Wilkes and Wilby, 1999, that shows how important the choice of intensity model is, especially if you're interested in the upper tail of the precipitation distribution. This study basically concluded that the mixed exponential distribution is the best available distribution for getting the upper tail correct. I think it's also an appropriate point in the talk to mention that most of the models that are available for precipitation modeling with weather generators tend to underestimate interannual variability especially. And this is a problem that's referred to as overdispersion. One of the ways that weather generator developers have addressed this problem is to include low frequency variability through ENSO or other large-scale modes of climate variability. Even when you do that, you still underestimate the interannual variability to some extent. So moving to the non-precipitation variables, WGen type models use a first order autoregression that basically looks like this. Here, XT is a 3x1 vector that has the standardized values of the current days, Tmax, Tmin, and solar radiation. XT minus 1 is the same thing for the previous day. A and B are 3x3 arrays that are functions of the leg 0 and leg 1 cross correlations between these three variables. And the final term there is just a 3x1 vector of standard normal values. And the idea here is that this equation will actually produce standardized output, that is mean 0, variance 1, but with the proper leg 0 and leg 1 correlation among the variables that are being modeled. And then, of course, we get the properly dimensioned values by multiplying by a standard deviation and then adding in the mean. So this is just a simplified example using two variables, Tmax and Tmin. So the graphic at the top shows that series of basically correlated noise. So Tmax on the left and Tmax on the right. We multiply those by the standard deviation and then add in the daily mean. And then at the bottom there, you get 1 year of generated data with the proper correlation between Tmax and Tmin and also with themselves. In most applications, we would actually specify separate curves here for the standard deviation and the mean for wet days and dry days, and that would allow us to then condition on precipitation occurrence. One of the things that I wanted to mention here is that a lot of weather generators are now being implemented within the framework of generalized linear modeling. And this has a couple of advantages. One is that it's more parsimonious. In other words, there are fewer parameters to specify when you do that. The other thing that it really allows you to do is to include covariates like, say, ENSO, instead of having to parameterize the model once for the negative phase, once for the positive phase, once for the neutral phase. You could just include something like the Southern Oscillation Index or something like that as a continuous variate. Now, there are a couple of problems with WGen, and one of the first ones that came out in the literature was that the original WGen formulation assumed that these correlations and cross-correlations were consistent over the whole U.S. and throughout the entire year. And of course, that's not the case. They demonstrate quite a bit of variability. Most applications now actually use site-specific and time-specific correlation. A bigger problem, and one that still exists to a large extent, is that there's an assumption of normality for the non-precipitation variables in these kinds of models. And Harmel, for example, looked at Tmax and Tmin distributions all over the U.S. and found that, in fact, they're not normal. At almost all locations have skewed data, and in some cases, they're even bimodal. Here's a particularly troublesome example. This is an example from the UK, and the solid line is the dry day observed distribution for solar radiation, and the dotted one is what you get through the normality assumption in WGen type models. You can see that they have the same mean and the same standard deviation, but the shape of the distribution is completely wrong. And so this has actually led to development of some alternatives that I'll talk about in a few minutes. With WGen, you also get occasional errors, such as Tmin being greater than Tmax, a physical impossibility. And the other thing is that WGen and similar models are really designed for single-site generation. Despite these issues, modified versions of WGen, and I've just listed a few of them here, remain really popular choices due to the simplicity of the model and also to its wide application. So some of the alternatives have included the use of semi-empirical distribution. So probably the most common model that does that is LARS-WG. And this model basically bins up the observed data and just uses values randomly drawn from those bins so that the distribution of the observed data and the generated data should match quite well. This study by Mark Parlange and Rick Katz used variable transformations, so square root transformations, for example, so that you actually don't violate that assumption of normality. Resampling weather generators have become pretty popular. So for example, just resampling from the observed data, you know that you're likely to reproduce that distribution. They're non-parametric, so that normality assumption disappears. They can easily be expanded to include multiple sites, so that's really good if you're into hydrologic modeling, for example, where you need to simultaneously generate synthetic series over a watershed. There's a couple problems, though. The synthetic data look too much like the observations. You're basically limited to the observations if you're doing resampling. Also, unrealistic extreme events, again, because you're sampling extreme events from a population in which those events are, by definition, rare. One of the models that I've worked on developing is what we've called the spectral weather generator, and this is described in two publications listed there. If we begin with a month of daily T-min data, we first remove and record the mean and the trend, and we then call the series T. Subject the data to a Fourier transform to produce TF in the associated power spectrum. If we do this for multiple months of T-min data, we then average those power spectra for each month and for each ENSO phase, at least in this study, that's the way that we did it. And then if we take the square root of those spectral estimates, we get the mean amplitude of the variability across frequencies. So if you do this in my part of the Midwest, for example, you see a spectral peak in the 3 to 5 day range that's really associated with the passage of transient mid-latitude weather systems. So if we want to generate data for a month, we generate a random vector. And we've actually implemented now in this weather generator a random number generator that includes skewness. And this allows us to actually get skewness in the resulting data. We take the Fourier transform of that random vector, and then we combine that with our spectral estimates to get this new series YF. If we take the inverse Fourier transform of that, we get a new T-min series that has the appropriate variability across that range of frequencies. The approach for T-max and radiation is the same, but there's two additional constraints. We require T-max to be greater than T-min, which seems like a reasonable thing to require from a weather generator. And we also have to require that the correlation between T-max, T-min, and radiation is properly generated. And I'm not proud of this, but in the current formulation of this model, we actually just use a brute force method. So we generate a series. If the correlation between those is good enough, then we move on. If it's not, then we regenerate the series. So I'm interested in thinking about new ways to preserve correlation and cross-correlation in this model. The process is completed then in much the same way that we would complete the process for WGen, by multiplying the time series by the wetter-dry day standard deviation and then adding in the mean so that we get properly dimensioned values again. So here's an example from one of those publications that shows the skewness of these variables. So we have T-max on the left, T-min in the middle, and solar radiation on the right. And the dots, the small dots there, show what you get from WGen, and the circles show what you get from the spectral model. And it's not perfect, but you can see that WGen generally produces skewness values that are quite close to zero, when in reality, a lot of these variables don't have zero skew. Also, because we're including more information about variability through the spectral approach, we actually do a better job of reproducing interannual variability. The WGen model takes into account lag one autocorrelation, whereas in the spectral model we have a whole month of information with regard to that variability. And it's still not perfect, but it does a little bit of a better job of reproducing that, the interannual variations. We also found that it better reproduces freeze events. So for example, extreme cold events, which can be very important if you're using this in an agricultural application. However, it's not all roses. The spectral model has a larger number of parameters than WGen type models do. It requires a longer amount of time to run. So if that's an issue, the spectral model might not be a good choice. Expanding it to include additional variables is difficult. And also, it's like many of the WGen implementations, it's really a single station weather generator. So one of the last things I want to talk about, I've got a couple more slides here, but for a lot of applications, particularly those in hydrology, there's a need to generate series simultaneously for multiple stations. And what I mean is that we need to go beyond interpolating weather generator parameters. In a lot of studies, we have the ability to determine the parameters for a few sites and then interpolate among those sites if we want to generate data somewhere else. That's not the same thing as generating data that has the proper spatial autocorrelation. There really have been two approaches to this in the literature so far. The first is to condition the parameters on circulation. So if you take all of the available upper air data for a region, determine some sort of classification for the circulation patterns, and then parameterize the weather generator separately for each type, you can do that. The second thing is to drive site-specific weather generator applications at a number of sites using spatially autocorrelated random numbers, and that's something that Dan Wilkes at Cornell has really sort of spearheaded. There is a new paper actually in press right now by Begoria and Jones, and I think they're both here, but they're not in the room. This paper provides an overview of existing methods for multi-site generation and also proposed a new method for preserving spatial and temporal autocorrelation among multiple sites. There's also an interest in incorporating finer temporal variability. I won't talk about these in detail, but there have been a few studies that have looked at, for example, generating precipitation data on a storm basis or even within a particular storm. There are some issues associated with this, particularly the lack of really high-resolution data available to the community. If you're interested in generating data at the five-minute time step, you're going to have trouble coming up with the data required to parameterize the model, unless you collect it yourself, of course. I think there are a few roadblocks to successful application of weather generators. Although I think a lot of good weather generators have been developed, there's clearly a disconnect between the developers of weather generators and the full spectrum of weather generator users. There are some exceptions to this. The DSAT system uses a Weatherman as a subsystem that allows a user to choose a data generated by a number of weather generators. Clima is a weather generation tool as well. But at the end of the day, there's still a lot of weather generators that have been built that are really only usable by their authors and a few close collaborators. And I'm guilty of that too. The spectral weather generator that I developed has really only been implemented in Weatherman because I had a lot of help from people that are involved with DSSAT at University of Georgia and University of Florida. However, I think some of the differences among these models that I've shown today suggest that we also really want to avoid black box approaches. In other words, I don't want users to go out and use WGen or the spectral model without really knowing what the implications of that are for their work. So a couple of summary points. Most weather generators are variations of the pioneering work of Clarence Richardson, who's at the USDA. This is a first-order autoregressive model. A lot of newer models attempt to overcome some of the shortcomings that I described, but really the same general framework is used. There are a lot of alternatives. I talked about what some of those were. There is a renewed interest, I think, in generating data for multiple sites simultaneously, and I think that that'll benefit the crop modeling and hydrologic modeling groups. And the last thing I want to say is just that I think the weather generator to use differs an awful lot from application to application. And there's no sort of silver bullet as far as weather generators go. I think that the details and the shortcomings of different weather generators will differ considerably depending on the application. Thank you.
So we have time for about one question. Could you repeat the question in the mic? We got a question.
Sure.
Any questions?
Yes.
Your weather generator that you're doing with this DFT, you compare that to what in AR1 is that spectrum? And which spectrum did you compare that to? You had that font that had that thing. What did you compare that to?
I'm not sure I understand the question.
You had two spectrum that you had there that you were generating weather from. I think you had one that was your DFT, and I didn't catch what you were saying.
The other one was just the standard WGen model. So they were being compared in the time domain, of course.
So that was based off of this AR1 representation?
That's correct.
Okay, fair enough.
Okay, well then, thank you.
Thank you
very much.